You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up another week, another possible government shutdown. We'll get the latest in the fight at the Capitol in just a bit.
More than a century ago, Congress passed laws to regulate companies from getting too large and dominating the market. The goal of these laws were to keep competition fair and prevent companies from manipulating the market and becoming monopolies.
While these laws have been around since the late 19th century, we've entered into a new era of really big corporations. Companies like Google and Amazon, whose size, scope, value, and power rival the Gilded Age monopolies that controlled industries like steel and oil.
Our next guest says it's time to revisit these laws in order to better regulate these companies. And if we don't, it might lead to deeper inequality and growing national.
Tim Wu is an author and the Julius Silver Professor of Law, Science, and Technology at Columbia Law School. His latest book is The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's take us back to the initial creation of these antitrust laws. They're passed in Congress, and then a bunch of years later, there are some presidents who actually try to enforce them. What was the intent, and what were the goals of these antitrust laws at the time?
Yeah, no, it's a good question and worth looking back at. So, you know, more than 100 years ago, the economy was a little bit like it is now. It became dominated by a number of monopolies, some of them well-known, like Standard Oil, some of them less well-known, like the Trust for Rubber, the Tobacco Trust, and so on and so forth, U.S. Steel Company. And the outrage and the reaction to this a transformation of the economy, which consolidated wealth into very few hands and was very hard on workers and employees, produced the antitrust laws, the Sherman Act. And, you know, that's more than a century and a half ago, but it represented this sort of restatement of American values, that this was an economy designed to be competitive and a country where democracy depended on diverse and decentralized power.
And we literally had a state of affairs where if things went on as they were, we would have had maybe only one oil company, period. Only one steel company, rubber company, tobacco company, so on. There, in a lot of key industries, there would not have been competition, right?
That was the way it was, actually. They went all the way towards merger, towards full monopoly. You know, the American economy was transformed, frankly, in the Gilded Age into this, like, one monopoly per industry. And the idea was that they were wise and you could trust them and, you know, it was an advance over competition, but it was a very big break from what had been the way America and, frankly, the whole West had operated.
And you've traced the history of how we think of antitrust laws, and we'll get into more of the original intent by them, but you see a big change led by, among other people, Robert Bork, best known for his Supreme Court nomination, ultimately unsuccessful. He and others promoted the idea, a really more narrow idea of what antitrust is, that all you looked at was the price benefit, the cost to consumers, and that you ignored everything else. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So there's a period, you know, basically from the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt into the 1980s, where antitrust is part of the American constitutional makeup. Big companies are routinely broken up or challenged. There's a whole many cases, Standard Oil, AT&T, IBM, you just go on, Alcoa. And in the 80s, we took a different attitude, inspired by Robert Bork, University of Chicago, that said, you know, the law has gone way too far, really. We should only be concerned about prices for consumer. And it, as I suggest in the book, enfeebled, weakened the law and led us back to where we had been.
What is the damage if we let these trusts, these monopolies, virtual or actual monopolies, thrive and go unchecked?
Yeah, I think that's something we're actually seeing firsthand. So the economic harm, the most straightforward, is you pay higher prices. And, you know, anyone who's looked at the pharmaceutical drug industry knows what that looks like. It'll just prices going up and up, or cable broadband services, or just cable TV up and up and up, you know, no competition. But I think there are deeper costs as well. For one, industries that are dominated by one or two companies tend to stagnate. For another, the concentration of economic power also concentrates wealth in a few hands. And finally, I think the political fallout is serious. When you have very concentrated, powerful industries, they're effective in getting their own will over what people tend to want. And, you know, you name an area, I'll show you a large group of people want something different, frankly, a majority, and an industry that gets its way. So I think our politics have been distorted, even corrupted by concentrated private power.
Talking to Tim Wu about his new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. A big concern you point to in the book for the original trust busters was this idea that once you got to a certain point, you could keep other people out of your business. So with Standard Oil, oh, you wanted to make your own oil? Well, we've got all the pipelines. We've got all the refineries. We will crush you. Is that a big concern that not only does this monopoly company control the prices, they control the price of admission if you want to play in that industry?
Yeah, that's a good reading of the book. I think this is something deeply underestimated by economists, which is the ability of an industry, once it gets there, to build a moat or a wall or a buried entry, and defend itself. You know, a company like AT&T was virtually immune to competition. In our times, you know, the idea of taking on a tech company like Facebook or Google seems like complete suicide, not to mention the wireless carriers or the airlines. So, you know, I think this is one of the problems, and you end up with a very different kind of economy than was once the American vision, which was one where, you know, people come here to start companies, a land of opportunity, you know, move here and take your shot. It's very different when you face all these barriers and obstacles created by other players.
Now we've got this big technology industry built on the foundation of the internet, and it seemed like the idea was out there that, well, this is a different kind of economy. These are different kind of businesses. Maybe we need the scale that a big company can provide. These are different. We don't need to think about them in an antitrust kind of way.
Yeah, I would suggest that, you know, for the first 20 years of the tech industries, and I mean Silicon Valley's latest incarnation, the web companies, a fairly rosy view of them. A company like Facebook or Google, you know, they can do no wrong. They're really well-meaning guys. I think, but increasingly people start to say, what's going on here? This used to be the most competitive industry in the United States. This was the golden goose, the promise of America and the frontier. And, you know, what's happened? It's really about a couple of big guys. And if you're lucky, you get bought out. But otherwise, it's hopeless. And, you know, it's a cycle. You know, what was yesterday's open season becomes an impenetrable monopolized industry, which is why we need the antitrust laws.
And we just saw some emails disclosed, I think it was by a member of parliament in Great Britain, and it involved emails within Facebook saying, yeah, these companies will give access to this information, but these companies are kind of competitors. Let's lock them out of this stuff. Do you see a parallel between that and saying, yeah, let's not let these competitors use our, say, oil pipelines?
Yeah, I think it's very similar. You know, I think Facebook in our time is one of the poster childs for the curse of bigness. You know, not only have they managed to keep out or buy out their competitors, they've also shown the danger of a company that regards itself as above the law. That was one of the real concerns of the original antitrust law. The idea that private companies could become more powerful than government, and in fact, sort of immune to government. And if you look at all these leaks of emails and so forth, it's clear that Facebook has thought it can buy itself out of any problem. Clear they also have been very risky with American democracy, running great risks with American democracy, allowed themselves to be hacked by the Russians, all because they just wanted to dominate their industry and make money. So I think that they show, along with, you know, like pharmaceuticals, the pressing need for us to rethink some of these old ideas about private power and its control.
We're talking to Tim Wu. He's an author and professor at Columbia Law School. His latest book is The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. He's with us to talk about why he says antitrust laws should be updated in an era of big companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, and many more.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should the government break up companies like Amazon and Google? Do you think these companies should be regulated at all? Does the size of these companies impact how and if you use them? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the role of antitrust laws in an era of big companies that dominate the technology, pharmaceutical, e-commerce, and other markets. Tim Wu is with us, author and professor at Columbia Law School. His new book is The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the influence these big companies have? Do you think it's a problem with regulation, or do you think that this is how the market works? What questions do you have about our current antitrust laws? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Tim, getting back to the early days of antitrust laws in the United States, so you write that it was kind of a historical fluke that they started to be enforced. This law, the Sherman Antitrust Act, was passed in Congress, and then it just kind of sat there, nice piece of paper. And then William McKinley was assassinated, and Teddy Roosevelt comes in and starts to bust the trusts. Is there a Teddy Roosevelt out there today who's going to take up this mantle?
I mean, I sure hope so. I give Theodore Roosevelt a lot of credit for having that virtue of courage. You know, it's amazing to look back at it. He came to the presidency and immediately took on the most powerful figures, private figures of his time. First J.P. Morgan, then John Rockefeller. I think many politicians would have considered that suicide. You know, these guys are so powerful. And he's a Republican. The Republican Party had sort of allied itself with big business. But no, he thought that this is a democracy, and if we don't do something in this period of incredible inequality, the people are going to turn to socialism or communism or anarchism or fascism. You know, people were angry. And, I think there's a lesson in our time. I think people are angry now. They don't see this economy working for them, and they want someone to do something. And so we need a Roosevelt to ride and really take aim at the private power in our time.
Larry in Milwaukee called in, wants to know, are there any groups or organizations that everyday citizens can join to fight monopolies? Are you aware of anything like that, Tim?
No, that's a great question. You know, the Open Markets Institute is a think tank in Washington. They're very concerned with this issue. You know, they're kind of trying to bring back the populist side of antitrust. You know, there was a period where this was a major political issue for both parties. 1912 election was almost entirely focused on antitrust. So yes, I think this is an issue people care about. Open Markets Institute is a good place to start.
We heard from Brandy on Facebook. Brandy writes, companies that focus on increasing profits every year worry me. Eventually, they get to the point where they have to cut quality and employee pay. It's a model that's like a pyramid scheme, and it hurts society in the long run. And you write, Tim, speaking of that phrase in your title, The Curse of Bigness, that companies, once they hit a certain size, seem to get less efficient, and some of those downsides that Brandy mentions can start to happen.
No, absolutely. And I think, it's just a function of excessive size. All of us know huge institutions that lose sort of their direction. And this is something, one of the key figures in my book is Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, but antitrust activist. That's really his, to my mind, most important role in the 20th century. And he had this real concern that when business got too big, it lost a sense of humanity. It started caring about things that don't really matter to the country, but matter only to itself. And I think we've gone very far in that direction. And really, we have an economy that's not working for people anymore.
Let's look at a company like Amazon. A lot of people are familiar with it, like it or not. They may buy stuff from it. It's ended up being a service that for the consumer, it provides fairly cheap stuff, more or less, very conveniently. And the everyday consumer might say, hey, wait a minute, let's not mess with that. I use it and I like it.
Yeah, the only question is whether if you accept convenience, and everyone loves convenience, it's hard to fight it. That we also have to accept monopoly, and that's where I draw the line. And you know, I'm perfectly willing to accept advances, but I think we have to be aware of the costs. And the long story is that when we allow just a few companies to rule something like retail, they do tend to concentrate profit just a few areas and leave the rest of the country behind, including retailers, including entrepreneurs who might have a better mousetrap. The only place to sell it is Amazon. Amazon can copy it. So, you know, we have to be a little more aware and just not single-mindedly focused on, you know, who gets me the better deal.
And yeah, you're concerned about inequality in the United States in the Gilded Age and what you're calling the new Gilded Age. And we see a lot of these high-tech businesses bringing huge economic booms in certain urban areas and a lot of rural areas in particular being left behind. Is that partly a story of monopolies and antitrust?
It is partially. I think, Louis Brandeis again. One of the things he believed in was a country of regions. He grew up in Louisville, and in his childhood, it was a place people move, start businesses, vibrant center. And today, it just seems like we've got this winner-take-all situation. Amazon, I live in New York, and a new office in New York. We don't need more, big businesses here in New York. We have everything. I think we can do better. There's advantages, I guess, but this is supposed to be a country with an economy that serves citizenship, that is a place where people come and be the best they can. And I think our economy has really stood in the way of everything America can be and everything American regions could be. I would love to live in a country where people thought of this as a place full of opportunity throughout the entire country, not just in one or two hotspots.
Talking to Tim Wu about his new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Let's talk on a practical level what a new antitrust effort might look like. And let's start with how the government reviews mergers or acquisitions of one company by another. What are we doing now? What would you like to see change?
Yeah, this is the priority. For some unknown, under the intoxication of excessively technical economic reasoning, we've allowed so many industries to become just, three or four players who easily cooperate. The airlines, pharmaceuticals, I go on, even fertilizer, for farmers. And what we need is a law. In fact, it would be better to have a congressional law that makes it clear the burden is on the merging parties to state how this is going to benefit the economy as opposed to, what they can get away with. Because we've just had 20 years of allowing all kinds of mergers that have been obviously bad for everyone except for the companies involved. And, everyone knows this. It's just one of these things that has to be changed.
Yeah. Are there particular examples of mergers or, again, Facebook buying Instagram is one example you give in your book where you think, hey, maybe a government regulator should have stepped in and just plumb stopped it?
I mean, how much time do you have on this show? I'll just give a couple examples. We let Ticketmaster buy Live Nation or vice versa, the greatest, so that, Ticketmaster is the for concerts and prices have gone up. The airlines have merged down to three airlines. Not known to many people, beer has merged, non-craft beer, into a duopoly. As I said earlier, fertilizer has merged, and farm chemicals have merged to put prices up for farmers. A pharmaceutical industry has merged and jacked prices with wild demand, and no real control on pharmaceutical pricing at all. Just across the line, and people who know particular industries know more than this. T-Mobile and Sprint are trying to merge right now so they can raise their prices. And it's just extraordinary that we've allowed this to happen. I think the people in business are like, I can't believe we get away with this stuff. We know why we're merging. We want to raise the prices, but I don't believe they let us do it. But for some reason, we have.
You write in the book, you look back at the post-World War II period, and some American analysts looked at Germany and the rise of Hitler and said, hey, one of the preconditions we think was the rise of these trusts, these single companies in many cases that would dominate a whole industry. They saw that as part of the puzzle. Do you worry about the effect of mergers, of huge corporations unchecked by government and their effect on society and representative government?
Absolutely. In the post-war region, as you suggested, bipartisan in Europe, too, everyone said, we need to realize that allowing corporate monopolies was a big player in the rise of fascism. Hitler was fortified in his efforts and consolidated his power with the help of IG Farb and other German monopolists. So we need to break up the German monopolies, which they did, and we need to break up our own companies unless we have the same kind of problems. And I think, you have a tendency when you have a concentrated economy towards more extreme politics, towards the rise of extremist politicians, which we see around the world, and the real danger that you have so much private concentrated power that if it ever starts to ally itself with government, actually this is something you see in China very right now, you have all the makings of a fascist state. And, you know, that's a big word, fascism, but I think we need to be constantly aware of the danger of returning and remaking some of the most serious errors of the 20th century.
And Tim, I think a lot of us don't want to talk about the 2020 presidential election yet. Let's talk about it. Do you see this? Do you see anyone being out there who's going to raise this as an issue in political campaigns?
You know, I think they need to. On the Democrat, both on the Republican and Democratic side, people are looking for answers. I think one of the reasons Donald Trump had a lot of success is he said he was going to take on big business. He said he was going to take on pharmaceutical pricing. He also blamed things on foreign enemies and immigrants, which I don't agree with. You know, that was part of why he was successful. And so I think it's important for candidates who are going to get somewhere to realize that people are not happy with this kind of economy and realize that part of the American vision is a decentralized economy. You know, I've heard some candidates talk about, obviously Bernie Sanders was out there, Elizabeth Warren was out there, but I think it's spreading further into the Democratic field, and that this kind of understanding of what people need, the kind of economic justice that matters, should be a big thing in the 2020 election.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Tim Wu is an author and the Julius Silver Professor of Law, Science, and Technology at Columbia Law School. His latest book, it's what we've been talking about, it's called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. He joins us today to talk about why he thinks the government should take greater steps to regulate mega companies from the pharmaceutical industry to high-tech companies like Amazon and Google.
Coming up, President Trump backed down from the threat of a government shutdown if Congress refused to allocate money for a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. His administration now says they'll look for the money elsewhere. We'll talk to a political scientist next about the issue. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, it's Cookies from West of the Border. Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of the Great Minnesota Cookie Book tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, President Trump had a rowdy exchange last week in the Oval Office with Senator Chuck Schumer and Representative Nancy Pelosi, leaders of their respective caucuses. At issue was the president's demand for $5 billion in federal funds to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border and the risk of a government shutdown.
20 times Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wall. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said
okay,
it.
Okay, you want to put that
you've
on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely. And I am proud, and I'll tell you what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle.
It seemed all but certain that the government was shut down after Democrats and Republicans in Congress dug in their heels over border security funding despite a looming deadline this Friday.
But today the White House signaled it would back off the shutdown threat and find funding for the wall through other means.
Our next guest is here to talk about the politics of government shutdowns, why they seem to be utilized more frequently, and the impact these have on the way government works.
Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course, happy to be here.
All right, the news changes from minute to minute sometimes, but at the latest, it looks like this a partial shutdown. It wouldn't be the whole shebang.
Right.
Partial shutdown maybe isn't going to happen?
Probably isn't going to happen. Of course, they haven't really agreed on what the legislation that will come out of this will be. It's you know, signals from the White House, but no official word yet from President Trump as to what might actually be acceptable to him.
Let's give a listen to one of his spokespeople, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, going on Fox News this morning talking about funding the border wall and working with Congress.
We have other ways that we can get to that $5 billion that we will work with Congress if they will make sure that we get a bill passed that provides not just the funding for the wall, but there's a piece of legislation that's been pushed around that Democrats actually voted 26-5 out of committee that provides roughly $26 billion in border security, including $1.6 billion for the wall. That's something that we would be able to support as long as we can couple that with other funding resources that would help us get to the $5 billion.
That is a partial yes.
So other sources of the money seems to be a key thing here. She's hoping for $1.6 billion from Congress, which is not a slam dunk, but
right.
also the other $3.4 billion coming from where? Do we have any idea?
It's a little unclear. What we've seen is that they've asked a lot of different, all of the departments really, to see if they have funds in unspent funds, discretionary funds that may be available to use for the wall. But again, that's not really how the budgeting process works. So even if they were to find those funds, they still need congressional approval to use those to build a wall.
And is it likely that, at least given the current makeup of Congress, that they could get Congress to sign off on a change in the intended funding?
I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, you would still need 60 votes in the Senate. You have a Democratic caucus on both sides, both the Senate and the House, that's emboldened by the last election. I just don't see any way it either getting through the Senate with 60-vote margin, even if it were to get through the House in the lame duck session.
And the House is going to change, as you mentioned.
House
a big change,
over
40 seats, I think, at last count.
39, 40 seats.
So that doesn't make life any easier for President Trump
no.
on getting wall funding.
No, exactly. Nancy Pelosi has been forthright in saying this is just something that's not on the table for us. And so I think what you saw is prior to this, you know, last year, earlier this year, actually, when we had another shutdown, a relatively short shutdown, there was this kind of dynamic that it could have been blamed on Senate Democrats, maybe even House Democrats. And so there was an electoral incentive for Democrats to move on a bill there. I don't think you just don't see that same kind of dynamic at this point after the midterm elections.
Talking to Philip Chen from Beloit College, looking at border wall funding and the risk of a government shutdown, partial government shutdown, probably being averted, TBD still. Philip, let's talk about the blame game that gets played over these shutdowns. Mm-hmm. It usually looks like, in general, if somebody gets the blame for a shutdown, voters don't really like that. They want, in general, government to do the stuff that it does.
Mm-hmm. That's true. The political science evidence on this suggests that government shutdowns actually don't have a particularly long-term electoral impact. The public opinion impact, the memory sort of the American public, is relatively short on these, largely because they tend not last for that long, and they also tend to not have a massive influence. Yes, there is evidence that they affect the GDP and earnings. Obviously, there are hundreds of thousands of federal workers that will not be paid, and so there are real-life effects for a shutdown. But in general, the sort of long-term electoral effects fade quite quickly.
And a shutdown in December of 2018 might not be top of mind, say, November of 2020.
Exactly. In fact, I think it probably had faded from the minds of basically everyone in by the midterm.
That said, people don't seem to want to take blame. And Republicans in Congress didn't seem terribly happy when the president said, yes, I want this shut down. I will take the mantle.
Absolutely not. They, of course not. They want to be able to play that blame game, like you said. There's a political advantage to being able to say, This is the result of polarization, of sort of obstinance on the other side. And when you have the leader of your party stand up and say, I will gladly take the blame for this, that sort of takes the legs out from under you as far as how you can play that card.
Now, this is something that I don't think used to happen on our shows on the Ideas Network, where we could kind of count on almost semi-regular conversations about the next looming shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't used to do it this way, right?
Right. We didn't. This has been a... We've seen shutdowns they have been a part of American politics for, you know, since Carter, Reagan, that kind of era. But for the most part, we haven't seen the same kind of sort of high stakes shutdowns that we've seen more recently, largely because as the House and the Senate have polarized, the parties have become much further apart. And we have good empirical evidence that that's the case. It's much harder for both parties to find common ground, and the nature of the budgeting process is such that it's just very difficult to get a budget passed, which is why we don't actually see that many budgets passed. You hear a lot more about continuing resolutions, which are really just a way to keep the government open.
Right, and since we have these short-term fixes, we have these short-term ends of those fixes where there's a new deadline and a new fight with the possible risk of a shutdown, right?
Correct. And so, exactly, as you have short-term fixes, we aren't budgeting. Normally, if you were to do budgeting the way sort of Congress intends to do it, you would have a budget passed every year, and that would be sort of a regular, timely thing. Instead, we have these continuing resolutions. Sometimes you'll see them pushed off for maybe a year, sometimes for a few months, sometimes a few weeks, all about sort of the political power play to try to put the other side in a bind. But that leads to these sort of continual shutdowns. I mean, if we're talking a continuing resolution now that the last I saw maybe until February, it means we can say we'll probably be talking about a potential government shutdown around the middle of February.
Now, this is a huge question, and I don't know that anybody has the answer to this, but do you see there being a path from where we are now to what I think most people would agree would be a more reasonable path of, hey, we'll do a 2-year budget, kind of like mm-hmm. we are supposed to do?
I mean, I think that in the short term, no. Partially because, strangely enough, while most states work on a 2-year budget, the U.S. Congress, the federal government works on a 1-year budget. So that's actually been a proposal that some sort of institutional reformers within political science have proposed, is to move to this 2-year budget cycle so that you can have a longer time before having these conversations. So that's one possibility, but it's a long-term possibility. I mean, with the way that Congress is made up right now, the way the parties are positioned, I think it's unlikely that we'll see major movement on sort of institutional reform in that way.
One argument I've seen is that part of the problem is that Congress got rid of so-called earmarks or pork barrel spending, which got a bad rap.
Yes.
And it might be, hey, so-and-so congressperson, sacrifice, compromise your principles a little bit, and we'll build the hockey rink museum in your district, and you'll have something to show mm-hmm. that, you know, your voters. Without that to sweeten deals, there's less reason for people to compromise.
Yeah, that's been an argument that has been made actually quite a bit in political science, simply because earmarks, I don't think it's about necessarily compromising principles, but there are obviously incentives to vote for or against certain packages. And to do the kind of deal making that you need to do, earmarks were a really convenient way to do that. And truthfully, they made up such a small portion of the federal budget that cutting earmarks or eliminating earmarks was really more about sort of a public face, a public show, than it was about actually saving money. That being said, it was a really popular thing. I mean, this is the sort of the issue, right? That very popular things in the American among the American public often don't cost a lot of money, or very unpopular things in the case of earmarks.
We're talking to Philip Chen right now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He's with us to talk about the government shutdown that probably won't happen by the end of the week and the politics surrounding the U.S. border wall.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this latest fight over the wall that President Trump wants to build along the U.S.-Mexico border? How do you think Congress should handle these issues? What questions do you have about government shutdowns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We continue our conversation about the looming government shutdown that was seemingly averted today. Our guest is Philip Chen. He's an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. is border wall funding worth shutting down part of the government over? Are you tired of being on the brink of government shutdowns and funding crises in Congress monthly, almost quarterly at the very least? How would you like to see lawmakers handle these situations? What questions do you have for our guest about shutdowns as a political tool? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Philip, President Trump was very specific about what he wanted on the campaign trail, and since he wants to build a wall. Mexico, the original plan was going to pay for it. Now he's going to Congress for funding for it. But that very specific thing, not general border security improvements, but a physical wall in particular. Is that that symbolic and practical thing really driving the conversation here?
I think it is for a lot of his supporters and for him as well. I think he views this as, I'm sort of putting words in his mouth, but I think he views it as a major campaign project promise to actually build a wall. And that, I think, is problematic, because when you try to put it out as, you know, this is the thing that I will do, the other side knows exactly what you want. And there's plenty of ways for them to then frame that in a different manner. So I think that there is a lot of there's a very big symbolic importance to the physical wall in this case.
Is there language that could split the difference, where Democrats can say, yeah, we'll give some money to border security, and in some places that might look like a wall, and in some places it's a fence, and like, is there a halfway point where they can meet on a wall?
So I think that the Democrats, what we've seen when you look at what the Democrats in Congress have proposed, is they are trying to do that. They're trying to find a way to say, we are for border security, but not for a wall. They're framing this as, a wall is ineffective. We need better, newer technologies to protect the border. And I think the problem is that when you have a president who believes a campaign promise is to build a physical wall, that's sort of a non-starter. And you've seen that from Democratic leaders, is saying this is a non-starter. A wall itself is just not going to happen.
Let's bring on a caller now. Joe is with us in New Richmond. Joe, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I'll take my comments off the air, but I just want to say that I think I'm fine with shutting the government down for the border wall. We send billions of dollars all over the world, and we should take care of our country and our border first.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Joe, at least one person says, yes, the wall is worth it, and we should play hardball to get the funding for it.
I don't think Joe represents sort of a minority opinion on this one. I think that what we see is that this is a pretty common thing, is that when you have strong partisan sides on an issue, it makes sense that that there are signals coming from party elites, and so I don't think that this is a minority opinion at all. I think there's lots of people who are going to share that opinion.
Thanks a lot for that call. But not that long ago, this wasn't the absolute opinion of the leadership of the Republican Party.
Right.
Some supporters of the Republican Party, some elected officials of the Republican Party were on board with this. Many were not.
Mm-hmm.
Are they now? Is this just because of Donald Trump that the party is on board with this?
I don't think you can say it's just because of Donald Trump. I think what we've seen is a shift in the nature of the political parties, that as we've seen greater polarization, greater sort of ideological space between the two parties, issues quickly map onto that. And so whereas you may have had common ground, middle ground on something like immigration, even as recently as, you know, the second Bush presidency, we're seeing this. In many ways, I don't think what we've seen is Donald Trump as sort of a cause of this, but as sort of the effect of greater polarization among the parties.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Ted in Janesville. Ted, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Ted?
I have a couple of points, if I may. Number one, I'm concerned about the humanity of the whole situation with people, but my major concern is the ecosystem. You build a wall like that, and now as people, us as human beings, are controlling the environment of animals that use this system to survive back and forth, what is that going to do in long term?
Ted, thanks for the call. Ted mentioned humanitarian concerns, environmental concerns, the practicalities of the wall. There are a lot of things that people are worried about and how it would actually be implemented.
Yeah, I think this is a fair point as well. That in fact, there was just a recent article that came out from a county official, Republican county official in Texas, who actually runs, I think it's a butterfly sanctuary there, right on the border. And this is another environmental concern. There's lots of concerns that I think people have raised about their border wall. Nevertheless, in addition to sort of concerns about efficacy of whether this is the most effective way to secure the border.
Philip Chen is with us, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College, talking about the prospects for a partial government shutdown. It looks a little less likely as of the news today. Not out of the woods yet, though. Back to your calls. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, I'm pro shutdown. I think we should let it get shut down, and maybe they'll learn their lesson. And then I think when they restart the government, we should fire all the Republicans, fire all the Democrats, and start over with a non-corrupt government. Our current budget is $23 billion for border security. There's only 7 billion people on the entire planet. That's about $3 for every man, woman, and child on the entire planet is what we're about to spend currently on just this fiscal budget.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. In addition to a specific point, I think Mike shares a very common sentiment, frustration with both parties, with the political leaders, wherever they're coming from.
Yeah, I think this has been a running theme for the last, maybe 2 decades. We've just seen continually lower and lower evaluations of especially Congress. Congress, regularly sits in the sort of high single digits, 10-15% range of approval, simply because people don't like the way that Congress functions, and so that's a problem, because there is that our institutions rely on legitimacy and trust from the people, and without that kind of legitimacy or trust, we run into real problems with the sort of belief in the things that are passed by those bodies.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Part of the problem with that, though, is a person might be frustrated that Congress doesn't get things done. They may be frustrated with what it does get done. They may be frustrated with the other side for opposing their views. They might be frustrated with their own side if they perceive them as compromising. Mm-hmm. That distrust of Congress comes from so many angles. How do you fix that?
I mean, to some extent, I don't think you can fix it. There's some pretty good academic research that shows part of the reason is that people actually just don't like to see the way that government operates, that the physical act of democracy, of legislating, of passing laws, is not a particularly popular thing, because people don't like to see compromise. They have their own beliefs. They don't like to see their own side compromising. They don't like to see the other side winning. There's a lot of moving parts to it, and people tend to like more specific answers or clearer answers, and it's that's part of the research that has been out there that shows why we might have such low impressions of Congress.
30 seconds or so for a weird thought. Is it that our media brings us so close into the chambers and we see Congress at action where we wouldn't have 100, 200 years ago, that we have this more intense and visceral like of Congress?
Yeah, I mean, actually, you've brought up a really great point. There actually is a lot of evidence for that. And the media, and especially, interestingly enough, the Sunshine Laws that were passed to open meeting laws, things like that, they did some great things for learning about what was going on and reducing corruption. But they also opened up the process to the American people and resulted in sort of less trust or less interest, less faith in the way that the process works.
We'll leave it there for now, Philip. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course, happy to be here.
Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He joins today to talk about government shutdowns, their role in the political process, and more.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new national study finds that most people don't know much about how their state government works. A Wisconsin politics expert makes the case that we need to know more about civics at the state and local level.
Wisconsin dairy farmers are facing sustained low milk prices. That's putting many smaller operations out of business. We'll hear the latest recommendations from a state task force on dairy issues.
And Wisconsin historian John Gerda tells us the story of Milwaukee
and the unexpected twists and turns that made a trio of villages into the biggest city in the state.
That and our weekly roundup of national politics with the latest on the shutdown or not. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, mathematical algorithms shape our lives in lots of mysterious ways, from credit scores to criminal sentencing. A mathematics expert tells us how behind-the-scenes numbers affect our lives in unexpected ways and how to be human in the age of the algorithm. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show.
Coming up next is the news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll talk with incoming Attorney General Josh Call about his priorities for the state, as well as the recent Republican push to restrict his power. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.